I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are writers Michael Chabon, Ayelet Waldman, and Fida Jurius, contributors to the Kingdom of Olives and Ash collection of essays, and Yehuda Shaul of the Israeli NGO Breaking the Silence. They're joined in conversation by New Israel Fund CEO Daniel Sokatch. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces our program.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. The conflict is known by other names, but 6 days stands out because so much happened in such a short time to change so much. By the time the ceasefire was called, the young nation of Israel had captured territory from Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, defended its right to exist, proven itself as a military power, and changed the balance of power in the Middle East. But that victory came at a cost. It started with what became a 50-year military occupation of the West Bank with no end in sight. It includes the flashpoint of East Jerusalem. Israel still controls entry and exit from Gaza, and it created for many of us what the Forward's editor-in-chief Jane Eisner has called, quote, a confusing mixture of wonderment and dread, joy and despair, pride and embarrassment. To get the conversation off the ground tonight is our moderator, Daniel Sokatch. Daniel is the CEO of the New Israel Fund, the leading organization committed to equality and democracy for all Israelis. Before joining NIF, he served as the executive director of the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco, the Peninsula, Marin, and Sonoma counties. Daniel will do the honors of introducing our panel, and let's give him a hand and bring him out. Daniel.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you, Stephanie. I want to thank the JCC for hosting this event, although I think most of us in this room would readily support the idea that all kinds of conversations are important to have in the community, especially the hardest ones. That's what we're supposed to be as a Jewish community. We are an argumentative people of the book. And yet, some conversations have become so frightening and so fraught that certain institutions in the community would rather avoid them. I've had rabbis, NIF supporters of major synagogues in cities across the country tell me that they just don't even want to have an Israel conversation anymore because it's so difficult and so challenging. So I really do want to thank the JCC for hosting what will be a difficult and challenging, but I hope enlightening, and we'll talk about it later, but even hopeful conversation about an issue that is far too important to avoid or sweep under the rug. As Stephanie said, this week actually does mark the 50th anniversary of a seminal moment in Israel's history, and I would argue in modern Jewish history and perhaps even in world history. And again, the ramifications of this event, the Six-Day War, are things that we are living with and trying to talk about and wrestle with even now. The occupation, which is a term that is sometimes frowned upon here in the American Jewish community, somewhat ironically, since in the early 2000s, then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon raised the issue of the occupation on the floor of the Knesset, the IDF, successive Israeli governments, and High Court of Israel all refer to the occupation. The governments, successive governments of Israel have applied the Fourth Geneva Conventions to the occupied territories, even as some of them have disputed the exact designation of what the political situation in the territories is. And the High Court of Justice has used the word occupation. And in fact, just last March, the retiring head of the Mossad, a guy called Tamir Pardo, in making his first public remarks after leaving his position, said that in his estimation, again, this is the head of Israel's intelligence agency, most important intelligence agency, Pardo said, in his estimation, Israel only faced one existential threat. It was not an Iranian nuclear program. It was not even the conflict with the Arab states around it. It was the unresolved conflict with its Palestinian neighbors and, he said, the occupation. So no problem as big as the occupation can ever be resolved or solved or healed or fixed by not talking about it. And in 2004, to speak out about what was happening in the occupied territories and to draw attention of the Israeli public to what was being done in their name in the occupied territories, a group of former Israeli soldiers who had all served in the territories created a nonprofit organization, Breaking the Silence, Shovrim Shtika in Hebrew. When members of Breaking the Silence met the novelist and essayist Ayelet Waldman at the Jerusalem Writers Festival in 2014, they invited her to tour with them the city of Hebron, which is a city of more than 200,000 Palestinians, in the midst of which is a settlement of several hundred Israeli settlers who are guarded by hundreds of Israeli soldiers right in the core of the city. I and some of you in this room have taken this tour with Breaking the Silence, and it's a very challenging, very difficult thing to do, but also a critically important thing to do if you really do care about what is happening to and in Israel and in the territories. What Ayelet saw on this tour disturbed her greatly, as it's bound to do, and she later described the events to her husband, Michael Shaban, and they both came to understand that they wanted to do something to change the situation there. And they realized, in their words, that storytelling itself, bearing witness in vivid, clear language to things personally seen and incidents encountered, has the power to engage the attention of people like us who'd long since given up paying attention or have simply given up. So working with Breaking the Silence and other local Palestinian and Israeli activists and NGOs, Michael and Ayelet invited 24 acclaimed writers from around the world to visit the West Bank and to Gaza and to share what they saw with the world. Over those 2 years, these authors came and they saw and they wrote. And the result is a remarkable anthology, Kingdom of Olives and Ash, Writers Confront the Occupation. It's a collection of unflinching, very painful, often devastating testimonies at the ground level to the human consequences of this occupation, which is so often seen from afar as an intractable abstraction, but which is not necessarily so. In the words of Israel's greatest human rights attorney, Michael Sfard, one day, he said, the occupation will end. Well, this is a story about what's happening now in that territory. And as I said, it's a painful one. It's an important one. And I appreciate our ability to have the kind of civil and respectful conversation that we in this city, in San Francisco, need to model for Jewish communities around the country. So with no further ado, I'd like to invite to the stage our speakers. They'll come out all together. Come on out, guys. And I'll start telling you about them. Ayelet Waldman is the author of the book, A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life, and the novels Love and Treasure, Red Hook Road, Love and Other Impossible Pursuits, and Daughter's Keeper, as well as the essay collection Bad Mother, A Chronicle of Maternal Crimes, Minor Calamities, and Occasional Moments of Grace. She's the editor of Inside This Place, Not Of It, Narratives from Women's Prisons, and she lives in Berkeley with her husband Michael, with whom she edited this volume. Michael is the author of numerous novels, among them Moonglow, Telegraph Avenue, Yiddish Policeman's Union, and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which was awarded, oh, I love that one too, which was awarded the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. He, not surprisingly, lives in Berkeley with Ayelet. Sitting next to them is Fida Tirius. And Fida is a Palestinian who is from, well, originally from Lebanon, right, by way of Cyprus, and then the Galilee, and then Ramallah. Fida is a writer and an editor and a freelance business consultant. She's contributed short stories and articles to various publications, including This Week in Palestine, Mondo Weiss, The Palestine Chronicle, and 972 Magazine. She's the author of 2 books of short stories on village life in the Galilee, entitled in English, Our Small Life and The Gentleman, And she's working on My Return to the Galilee, a memoir of her return to Israel after the Oslo Accords. And Fida told me about how her family was the first, or one of the first, Palestinian families admitted back into Israel where they came from after the Oslo Accords. So with that, let's begin a conversation. I'll never, ever, ever live that down. No. The guy I've known the longest and whom I know the best on the stage is Yehuda Shaul, with whom I first went to Hebron 7 or 8 years ago, the first of three such visits, which seems like a lot, but here's a guy who does it all the time. Yehuda was born and raised in Jerusalem in an ultra-Orthodox family, and he graduated from a yeshiva high school in an Israeli settlement in the West Bank. He served in the IDF as a commander and platoon sergeant in the 50th Battalion of the Nachal Brigade from 2001 to 2004 in Bethlehem and Hebron. Yehuda founded Breaking the Silence in 2004 with a group of fellow veterans, and he currently serves as the organization's co-director. He's now studying political science at the Open University of Israel. I don't think I forgot anybody else. So let's start with the two of you.
Okay.
As the mother and father of this project, you have, I guess, an aunt and an uncle and a cousin here. So, putting together a group of people to tell their stories is not an obvious thing for two people who, when one reads the introduction of this book, write, "We were done. We didn't want to think about it. We didn't want to talk about it." So what changed, and how did you come up with this idea?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Michael and I, one of the first things we did together as a couple, one of the first places we went was to Israel, because I was born in Israel. I grew up sort of going back and forth. And when we met and got engaged, I said to Michael, "Well, you won't really know me, you won't really understand me until you see Israel." So back in 1992, we went to Israel. And then we did not go back for 20 years, more than 20 years. And it wasn't a boycott. It wasn't necessarily even conscious. But it really was an expression of ambivalence and anxiety and ultimately disengagement, which I think is very typical of many American Jews, of our generation and especially the generations that come after. But then I was invited to a book festival at Mishkenot Shananim, an artists and writers retreat colony in Jerusalem. And when I was a student at Hebrew University, Mishkenot Shananim was kind of this, it was very exalted. And I couldn't quite believe that I had been asked to go there. So I very excitedly said yes before I even realized that this was going to be the first time I went back in decades. When I knew that I was going back, I reached out to a colleague of Yehuda's at Breaking the Silence and asked him to take me to Hebron, and he took me and a few other writers who participated in that festival. And what I saw there was shocking. I mean, I had been living in Israel for years and years, and I had no idea of what went on in Hebron. And not only that, if someone had criticized Israel and said, "There is a city on which Jews are permitted to step, but the Palestinians who own the homes on that street are not permitted to step," I would have called you a liar. If you had told me there was a city, a Palestinian city, in which there were areas, large areas that belonged to Palestinians where they were barred from entering, I would have called you a liar. So seeing that was truly devastating. And seeing, I saw two young teenage boys arrested for simply, you know, they were taken away by the soldier. Ultimately, I believe they were released. But for their crime was to stand at the top of Shuada Street and put their foot over the line, the demarcation. But if I had seen just that, I came home, I wrote an essay for The Atlantic, and that might have been that. But the next thing that happened was I went to Tel Aviv, a city I love. And I had you know, dinner and breakfast and lunch with my writer friends and drank into the night with, you know, Asaf Gavron and Edgar Keret and other Israeli writers and musicians and artists. And it was wonderful and exciting and exhilarating. And I felt so at home. In a way that I don't really feel here in the United States. I've never felt at home here. My family's from Canada. I was born in Israel. The United States is my adopted home, but it's never been a really good fit. That moment, that feeling at home, that was the moment that made that gave birth to this book and gave birth to a new attitude on my part towards Israel and Palestine. Because the minute I felt at home in this place, then it became my responsibility. It became my responsibility, and it became something that I had to work my hardest to change. And Yehuda, wise man that he is, we met in Hebron, actually, in a community center on top of, in this wonderful community center run by an organization called Youth Against Settlements. And he, wisely understanding exactly where my emotional state would be a few days later, met me for coffee in Tel Aviv, and together we cooked up this idea for the book.
You know, you said something, Ayelet, that really struck me. You described, and I certainly, this resonated with me, the way that, you know, if you had said certain things that you experienced or saw with Yehuda or, you know, in Hebron, if you said those things to people in the community, friends, people that we know in the Jewish community, they would say, you have to be lying. It can't be true. And then you also said that, you know, my favorite term when it comes to Israel-Palestine, right? The cognitive dissonance of being in Tel Aviv. You're in this, I mean, it's a great LGBTQ-friendly, liberal, artsy city with great food. And a few kilometers away is this 50-year-old grinding occupation, and people are able to live their lives without really thinking very much about it.
I mean, it was amazing when Michael and I came back to do our, there were 25 writers in the project, some Palestinian and Israeli, but mostly writers from all around the world. And we brought them in sort of in delegation, so to speak. Sometimes there would just be one writer, sometimes there were as many as seven in our group. And when we brought this group to Hebron, we also invited a bunch of Israeli journalists and international journalists to go with us. And the Israeli journalists, some of whom were friends of mine, kept coming up to me and grabbing me and saying, "Lo yuman," which means it's not to be believed. So these are people who were born in Israel, who grew up in Israel, who lived in Israel their whole lives, and their reaction to what they saw in Hebron was, "It's not to be believed."
I mean, that was my major takeaway, and it was first something that I would say to myself and subsequently became what I would say to other people. And when we returned, what I would say to people is, you think you know, you don't know. Like, until you go and see for yourself, everything you think you know is wrong. You can't imagine until you see it. It just doesn't seem possible. It doesn't seem, it's aside from whatever feelings of revulsion and horror and everything that it elicits in you, you just have this overwhelming unwillingness to believe your eyes, and yet that you can't. There's no way to escape what you're seeing.
I think that's part of the power of the way you guys built the book in having great storytellers. Some Israeli and some Palestinian, but really only a few, mm-hmm. And the rest from all kinds of other places, some places that are utterly unconnected to this story of ours. Mm-hmm. You know, when all of these different people, Israeli, Palestinian, Irish, American, British, when they come and they tell stories and the details feel the same and the observations resonate, you get this sense of what this really is in a way that it's very difficult to in reading the paper.
And they brought remarkable things to the experience. So one of the events that we did with Colm McCann, the Irish writer. And Colm comes from the point of view of having grown up with the Troubles. And he said, you know, my people are part of an 800-year struggle that seemed forever intractable. No more impossible, no less impossible than this struggle. And so his perspective was so helpful. And we also had Colm Tobin and Eber McBride. And so that was really interesting to see what they brought to it. Hilon Habila, who lives in America now but is originally from Nigeria, who hadn't really spent any time thinking about the Middle East at all. You know, he's got bigger problems in Nigeria. So But his perspective was also really interesting as someone from the African continent. And Tai Selassie also, she grew up in Britain, was born there, but her family is from Ghana originally, and she spent time going back and forth. So those experiences were really fascinating and illuminated different corners, which is exactly what we had hoped to achieve.
You're listening to writers Michael Chabon, Ayelet Waldman, and Fida Jurius, contributors to the Kingdom of Olives and Ash collection of essays, and Yehuda Shaul of the Israeli NGO Breaking the Silence. They're joined in conversation by New Israel Fund CEO Daniel Sokatch on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You know, we really have on this couch, right? We have an Israeli and a Palestinian. We have one of the authors, and we have the guy who founded the NGO that is sort of the Moreh Derech, the tour guide of this book in some ways. So I'd like to ask you both a few questions. First, you, Yehuda, you know, when Michael and Ayelet sort of describe their reactions in coming to Hebron for the first time. And again, as I said, that's something that most of us, even those of us who think we know, right? It's very different from what we expect. What was it like for you? I mean, here you were, a kid from an ultra-Orthodox background, a yeshiva bucher, an elite combat soldier in the Nachal, and you get put into Hebron. And what happens? What do you see?
Truth is that I come from a right-wing background. Yeah, so I did my high school in a settlement, and I have two sisters today who live in settlements, and an uncle who was a settler in Gaza up to 2005. But when I first arrived to Hebron, I was in shock, and I started thinking maybe I should refuse to serve, because things didn't make sense. The one thing that opened my eyes right away was the fact that settlers were allowed to attack Palestinians, and there was no law enforcement on them. For a very simple reason.
Would you describe what you actually mean by that for people who really are hearing this for the first time?
So I'll start from the general, and then I'll zoom in for one example that I remember very well. Is the occupied territories is not Israel. Okay, the sovereign power is not the Israeli government; it's the Israeli army. And by international law, the army in the occupied territory is supposed to protect the people who live there. But our mission as soldiers is we are there to protect the settlers. And if we see settlers attacking Palestinians, not our job. That's the job of the Israeli civilian police. So you have this division of labor. You stand in a post, you see a settler attacking a Palestinian, the best thing you can do is go on the radio, ask your headquarters to call the headquarters of the Israeli civilian police to send a police car to take care of the matter. If a Palestinian does something, you right away react because that's your job. So you have two communities living in the occupied territories, Palestinians and settlers, under two different legal systems, because Palestinians don't have civil rights like I have. They live under military law. Settlers live under Israeli civilian law, enforced by two different executive branches. Army, martial law on Palestinians, Israeli police, civilian law on settlers. Sorry. So one of my first days in Hebron, I was standing in a post in downtown near the largest settlement of Avraham Avinu. It was like afternoon. The settlers had like a protest tent on the Shuada Street, which used to be the main street of town. Today it's a sterile road where Palestinians cannot step a foot on. So they were praying mincha, the settlers, and two young Palestinian men came outside from the market, from the old city, trying to cross the road to a Palestinian neighborhood across the valley. And the second the settlers saw these young Palestinians, suddenly God was left aside and ran towards them and started yelling something like, "He has a knife, he has a knife," and started beating them up. And I look at my commander, he looks at me, and we run towards them and we grab these two Palestinians, we smash them into the wall, and we physically check them and we look for the knife because the settlers said that they have a knife, so they probably have a knife. It doesn't take more than 40, 50 seconds that I look at my commander, he looks at me, and we understand there was no knife. That was just a way to get us into the party. So we put the Palestinians down on the floor, turn our back to them, face the settlers, and ask them nicely to stop beating them up. And my commander goes on the radio and asks our headquarters to call the headquarters of the police so the police car will come and take care of the matter. And the settlers continue to beat them, and we get some punches and some kicks. And after like 5 minutes, settlers go into a car and drive away, and the young Palestinians stand up and want to leave. And we tell them, no, you should wait. The police is on the way. You should file a complaint. We would testify in favor of you. There is law and order in this town, right? And that's how you should do. So we keep them on the floor there, and after another like 10 or 15 minutes, the police shows up. They don't even leave the car. They ask my commander what happened. We tell them the story, and they ask, so where are the settlers who attacked? We say, they left there. We couldn't stop them. We couldn't. So there's nothing we can do, and they just drove away, and that's it. And that's where you look back at these, we looked back at these Palestinians kind of like, guys, sorry. You know better than us how things work, and we just know. It's not enough that you were attacked, right, and we couldn't do anything because our orders were not to touch the settlers. We kind of like stole away another 10 or 15 minutes from your time. We're sorry, you can go. And that's just one tiny thing. So that's my first reaction. It just didn't seem right.
Thanks. Fida, you bring, you know, here in this community, you bring a new perspective for many people who, despite how steeped we are in the conversation, in reading about the conflict, and for some of us about the occupation, it's not often that people in the American Jewish community get to sit with and hear from and speak with a Palestinian who has lived this experience. But you bring another fascinating perspective, which is almost unique in my experience, which is you are not only you're a person who has essentially lived on both sides of the Green Line, right? And again, for folks who are sort of just tuning into this conversation, about 22% of the population of the state of Israel is Arab, right? Arabic speaking people, Palestinian citizens of Israel, as they refer to themselves. In the West Bank, you have about 2.3 million to 2.7 million, depending on how you're counting it. And in Gaza, 1.9 million people. So, by the way, besograim, in parentheses, already when we talk about demography, if you look at the population of the West Bank, of Israel, of Jerusalem, and of Gaza, we have parity between Jews and Palestinians living between the river and the sea, which is just an interesting contextual point for us to consider. But you really can bring two perspectives to this conflict. You came back with your family to Israel, to the Galilee, and then you chose to move to Ramallah. So I'm wondering if you can talk to us a bit about your experience as a person born outside of Israel and Palestine, coming back to Israel, and then going into the territories, the occupied territories in Ramallah. And also, if you could sort of speak to the different perspectives brought by Palestinian citizens of Israel on the one hand and Palestinians in the West Bank on the other.
Thank you, Daniel. So my father left Israel in 1970 to Lebanon as a result of his political activism. At the time, he was exiled to Lebanon. He worked for the PLO as the director of the Palestine Research Center, which did economic and political research. It was a large center in Lebanon. It employed 82 people. I was born in Beirut, and in 1982, in the aftermath of the Israeli invasion of Beirut, things started to get, very ugly. We had the Sabra and Shatila massacres. In 1983, there was a bomb that targeted the Palestine Research Center. Several employees were killed, tens of passersby, and I lost my mother in that bombing as well, who was an employee at the center. Following this, 3 months after that, we moved to Cyprus. Several Palestinian institutions were relocated to Cyprus at the time. The research center was one of them. It reopened in Nicosia, but on a smaller scale. So I grew up, in Lebanon as a child and then in Cyprus as a teenager. There was no possibility of coming back home. We were exiled Palestinians. My father was, politically active. He's a writer and a lawyer. Suddenly the Oslo Accords happened and took us all by surprise. Suddenly we were able to go back home or back to the village that my parents are from, Fasuta in the Galilee, near the Lebanese border. I was jumping up and down when this happened. Finally we would be able to go back home to see what home was, to go back to our village, to our family, to our, extended family. We made the trip back in 1995. It was extremely emotional for all of us. And I then, you know, I got the Israeli citizenship by virtue of my father having it before he left, and my mother as well. So my brother and I acquired Israeli citizenship, and then, you know, we had to sort of integrate into the system. I studied Hebrew, and I began to look for jobs. And that was my first blink of reality when I started to understand that actually being a Palestinian in Israel was an entirely different matter from being a Jewish Israeli. Many times when I applied for jobs, I was asked if I had my army number. Young Israelis, you know, do mandatory army service. Palestinian citizens of Israel are exempt from this service, but I quickly understood that this was a way to kind of keep us out of employment as well, because you would be, you know, many times my army number would be requested, and if I couldn't provide it, I would be politely told that they would call me back, and the calls never came. Eventually, I did, you know, find a job in high tech, which I had studied computer science in England. And in the job itself, more glimpses of reality began to show. The Oslo Accords were fresh at the time. I heard my colleagues discussing them, discussing the situation with the Palestinians. There were often heated discussions, and I remember, you know, sitting in meeting rooms, looking around at my colleagues, my Israeli colleagues. I was the only Arab in the company, and I was, just as a little segue, I think I was hired probably only because of my English. And I remember looking around the room at my colleagues and just wondering how many of them had served in the war that I had undergone, that I had been through as a child in Lebanon. And after that, I began to piece together a few more things. People in my village lived at a different standard of life completely from that in, you know, Jewish Israeli towns and villages. Poverty was much higher. You know, at the time, if somebody was earning 3,000 or 4,000 shekels, it was considered, which is about, I guess, $800, it was considered, you know, a very good salary in our village, whereas, you know, that kind of money in an Israeli town or for an Israeli person was, you know, not high. It wasn't considered a good income. So there were differences in income. There were differences also in the budgets allocated for, you know, by the state, for education, for employment. There were very few business initiatives started in Arab localities. The feeling we got very much was that we were kind of tolerated, you know, sort of left to more or less fend for ourselves. We have the minimum support, governmental support, but there's a very big disparity. And then, you know, other things, you know, the picture started kind of forming stronger and stronger the more years I spent there. I was working somewhere else during the time of the Second Intifada. It was a high-tech firm in Carmiel, in the Galilee. Carmiel is built on the remains of three destroyed Palestinian villages, and this was a reality I tried to ignore every day when I went to work, because I needed the job, and I was in Israel, and I knew I needed to, you know, to continue my life there. But the Second Intifada was going on at the time, and I heard, you know, really horrible remarks at work. People were taunting and jeering, you know, how many do you think we killed today? And, you know, those kind of comments that you just thought, they created a really jarring sensation inside me, because outside of these comments, these were very nice people, mostly American and Canadian Jewish people who, you know, I befriended some of them on the job and whatever. But when it got to political discussions, these friendships would dissolve. You couldn't really have a conversation with somebody who didn't really, truly even regard you as an equal human being, and who, you know, as Daniel and as Ayelet have said, and as Yehuda has said, you know, that the perpetrates an occupation and doesn't really stop twice to think about it. Things are fuzzy for the Palestinians, because whether you live in Israel or, you know, inside the occupied territories, you're under a system of discrimination that just manifests itself differently. So ironically, the Palestinians in the West Bank look at us, the Palestinian citizens of Israel, with a huge measure of envy. I mean, anybody would kill for an Israeli ID if they could get it, simply because, you know, it allows you freedom of movement, at least inside Israel, without being stopped at checkpoints and going through the humiliations and the stress and the danger that they encounter every time they try to move around. You know, if you live inside Israel, you're protected from the settler attacks that are so rampant in the West Bank. And it also affords you, you know, medical care and, you know, basic education. But for the Palestinian citizens living inside Israel, we deal with a whole different layer of complex discrimination, which manifests itself in our lives in a very, very intricate, almost carefully woven way. And you keep coming up against this hidden barrier in everything you try to do, whether it's education or trying to find a job. I mean, in education, very few Arab students are able to secure any kind of study loans whatsoever, in Israeli universities, despite the fact that we are Israeli citizens. In employment, as I said, there's, you know, major discrimination. Arabs today still work, the majority of them still work in the lower paid blue-collar positions. And there's really the sense that you are very, very much an inferior citizen. You will never be accepted as a true citizen of the state. At the same time, the state asks from us that we display loyalty, that we refrain from showing our own Palestinian identity or trying, to show our unity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters in the West Bank, in the refugee camps, in the surrounding areas, and so forth. So there's really a demand for us to be, a full-fledged citizen when, in effect, we are not, and we are not treated as such. And so, really, for a Palestinian, whether you live inside or outside Israel, in Israel or in the occupied territories, it's out of the frying pan and into the fire. Why I decided to move to Ramallah was simply because I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't take living in a state where I felt like, a 10th-class citizen. There were many moments, where, and there still are today, actually, when you walk, for example, into a mall or into a government building, and we are nervous to speak Arabic. If we are speaking Arabic, we subconsciously drop our voices, simply because of the looks and the inherent feeling that you get of, cautious suspicion or hostility, or at best, an attitude of benevolent tolerance, by Israeli Jews. And any one of those reactions brings out very difficult, painful feelings in us, and we've kind of realized time and again that we will never really be equal citizens in this state, or it will take a very long time until that happens. So my journey has really been very difficult on both sides of the Green Line. Israel is sadly, it's a great democracy if you are Jewish, and it's a very discriminatory, racist state to its Palestinian population, whether those under occupation or those who hold its citizenship.
As I said, we're going to hear things that are very painful for some of us to hear. And it puts me in mind of the guy that you write about, Michael, Sam Bahur, who comes from Youngstown?
Yeah, Youngstown, Ohio.
Right. Tell us about the giant in his cage.
He was born in Youngstown, Ohio, to a Palestinian father and a Lebanese mother who was second generation. His mother was born in the United States. And he lived in Ohio until he was in his mid-20s, at which point, having studied telecommunications in university, and with Oslo, again, very fresh and with lots of people feeling lots of optimism about the possibility of building a Palestinian state, he and his wife moved to Palestine, back to the village, the part of, not a village, a neighborhood of Ramallah called Al-Bire, where his father had lived, to the house where his father had been born. And Sam went to work. And he was a man, and remains a man, with a vision. He's a kind of a visionary guy. He has big dreams, and he had this idea, I'm going to start the first wireless telephone service in Palestine, cellular phone service. And he did it. And it was a protracted, difficult experience. It was hard to do. The bandwidth itself, the very air itself, if you will, is controlled by the Israeli government, which rations bandwidth to Palestinians, so that, like as Sam explained it to me, like when the rest of the world was moving to 3G, it was still 2G in Palestine. Then the rest of the world started moving to 4G phone service. It's still 2G in Palestine. Now 5G is coming down the pipe, and still Israel won't let the Palcom, this company, install the kind of equipment and towers and so on that's necessary for faster service. So Sam was contending with all kinds of issues, and yet he was able to set up this company. It was very successful. It continues to be the largest private sector employer in Palestine. But he left, and he went to do something totally different, and he became the project manager for this consortium that was trying to build the first Western-style supermarket in Palestine.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writers Michael Chabon, Ayelet Waldman, and Fida Jurius, contributors to the Kingdom of Olives and Ash collection of essays, and Yehuda Shaul of the Israeli NGO Breaking the Silence. They're joined in conversation by New Israel Fund CEO Daniel Sokatch. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
This is in some ways an even more quixotic thing to try to do for Sam than the cellular phone company had been, in that he was even before the second intifada broke out, which it did shortly after he began work on this, it was already logistically a nightmare to try to do with permits and authorities and supplies. And then once they had gotten going, the second intifada broke out, and he's literally trying to build a glass palace in an area where missiles are being fired. And, you know, I compare him in my piece to that. It started to remind, when he was telling me the story, it was reminding me of the movie Fitzcarraldo, the Werner Herzog movie, you know, about this guy who's trying to carry a steamship over a mountain in South America so that he can have opera. So he can build an opera house, and there's opera in the jungle. And it started to feel like Sam got so consumed by this vision of not just a supermarket, but it was going to be a shopping mall, a mini mall, and it was going to have all of these things that hadn't, including a Cineplex and all of these things that really hadn't been done before. And again, in spite of everything, and he did it. And then he walked away from it. And in the course of our day together, you know, as I was hearing his stories, they were always stories of these sort of big dreams that took a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of sweat and hardship. And he accomplished them, and then he would never dwell on much in the way of a feeling of satisfaction or pride. And then it would be clear he had moved on. And I started to realize that it was all tainted for him, in a sense, because all of his... is all of his, what should have felt like success, ultimately ended up feeling like compromise. Mm. That he had only been able to do it by compromising principles, compromising values, and ultimately acceding to the occupation itself. It was the authority of the occupation permitted him to do everything that he did. And I think the realization that in some way or another his achievements were only achievements to the extent that the Israeli authorities had allowed them to be achievements, somehow it soured him on the whole process. And he began to feel like resistance for him in some way was going to have to incorporate a renunciation of the kind of things that he had hitherto thought were so important.
One of the things that when we were talking to Sam that was so compelling to me, and I think to you as well, is he talked about the process. This is an American citizen. He is an American citizen born in the United States. When he wanted to go for a business meeting, say, to meet Israeli colleagues, to meet international investors, colleagues in Israel, in Tel Aviv, at the airport, wherever, he couldn't just make an appointment and say, I'll meet you at 1, like a normal businessman does. He would have to say, I'll meet you sometime between, say, noon and 5. Why? Because for Sam, he has to go through a checkpoint. And one of the things that's important, I mean, we all think we know, we've all been through checkpoints.
Plus he had to get a permit.
Well, first, yes, of course. First he had to apply for a permit, and you had to apply the day before, but not before the day before, and get the permit for that day.
And it's only good from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. or something like that.
Right, so, you know, he turns into a pumpkin at 7 p.m., he has to get back before that. But, you know, we've all been through checkpoints, we've been to the airport. Checkpoints, you know, they can be aggravating and unpleasant, but they don't have to be utterly dehumanizing. The checkpoints between the West Bank and Israel are dehumanizing in a way that I've never seen before. They are a mass of people. They're open at, you know, they open them up, and there are hordes of people going through these very tiny metal chutes, like cattle chutes, enclosed on the sides, enclosed on the top. And there's this kind of a surge that for someone like Sam, I mean, Sam is, he's a tall, I mean, Michael calls him the giant.
Yeah, he's 6.5 feet tall. And this thing is, the height of this chute, as you call it, is nowhere near that high. And he the thing that, like Sam explained to me, is he has diabetes. So, and as he said, you know, one thing that that means if you have diabetes is you have to urinate frequently. And he would find himself in this situation where he was in the middle, halfway through the line, with a huge number of people behind him and a huge number of people in front of him. And he says, I have to pee. What am I supposed to do? Tell, like, go back? Because there's no bathroom.
You can't service. Move to the side. You're stuck in this
so
chute.
So if I go back, it means I have to go all the way back and I have to start all the way over again. If I, and what am I supposed to do? Go forward to tell the people in front of me, excuse me, I have to pee, so I get to cut the line and go all the way in front.
Even if it was physically possible to move ahead of them, which it probably isn't.
So ultimately, what he does then is just forego the opportunity to have the business meeting at all. It's so that he's, it's this inherently discouraging process that has the effect of discouraging and depressing and demoralizing the people who otherwise would be taking advantage of opportunities.
Which
that they
is
have.
The point.
Right.
It is not an accident. It is designed specifically to do just that. I think, Fida, you had something you were...
Yeah, I'd like to add something else, actually. The checkpoints can also, other than the fact that they are, you know, you're, as you mentioned, they're very uncomfortable, they're very humiliating, they're also scary because sometimes... There or frequently there are clashes between young people in Colombia refugee camp, which is the place that the checkpoint is actually called after. It's Colombia checkpoint because the area is called Colombia, and it's right at the entrance of Ramallah, and there's a refugee camp just inside the checkpoint. And frequently there are clashes between, you know, frustrated young people in the camp who may clash with the Israeli soldiers guarding the checkpoint. The soldiers would, you know, sometimes retaliate by opening fire. If you are, and this has happened to me, if you are in the line of cars waiting to cross the checkpoint, again, there is a long, you know, about half a mile stretch where there is concrete on both sides. So you can't turn around and come back. And you have people firing bullets. So sometimes, subconsciously, you know, you have to duck if you're hearing this sound. And you have to just pray that, you know, that the cars will move, that the soldiers will let them through, and that you will just get out of here. So it's a horrible feeling of being literally caged to the point where, you know, many of us, most Palestinians living inside Ramallah, refer to it between ourselves as the open cage or the open prison. The other thing, I actually worked with Sam for 5 years. As Daniel mentioned, I also do business consulting. Not just to go inside Israel. If Sam and I had, say, a meeting in Bethlehem, we had to use separate routes to get there. Because as a Palestinian, he wasn't allowed to use the routes that I, as an Israeli citizen, am allowed to use. Mm-hmm. So even, you know, making a simple meeting inside the West Bank, it's not even, you know, inside Israel itself, you still had all kinds of complications to worry about. If I got in the car with him, just because it was easier to drive to the meeting together, if we were stopped at a checkpoint, it was then to the discretion of the soldier who stopped us to say, you have an Israeli ID, what are you doing in this car? You're not supposed to be coming this way. So just to do very, you know, just to iterate what Michael said, just to do the very, very basic, simple things like set up a business meeting, you have to go through a checklist of all these things, you know, which in other countries or, you know, in the U.S. would be unthinkable.
I mean, and the crazy thing in Sam's case, too, is he's an American. He has a United States passport. And yet he was trapped in this horrible situation with his residency status, where he to leave to keep his to so as a U.S. citizen, he's living in Ramallah. He has to leave every 6 weeks and then come back in and get a tourist visa, and that was how he was able to live in Ramallah, start these businesses. His family, his children are born in Palestine, so they're residents of Ramallah, and he's routinely leaving and coming back until one day, for no apparent reason, for no reason he's ever really been able to find out, the immigration clerk, whatever you call him, as he's coming back into the country, decides to write
last permit
in handwritten. It's just
because he got a Palestinian ID. His request for Palestinian ID from years ago was suddenly accepted.
Yes, right. And so he now
wrote it in his American passport.
Yes, in his U.S. passport. That is the property of the United States government. So now, I mean, with the stroke of a pencil, this Israeli immigration bureaucrat is able to essentially obviate the full force and power of a United States passport and trap this American citizen now in Ramallah, where he no longer has that freedom to come and go that he had before.
And in fact, he commented on this by saying, you know, I'm not sure which was worse, the insecurity of having to leave every 3 months and come back, not knowing if I would be allowed to come back, or the fact that after I got the Palestinian ID, I became a prisoner.
Right.
You know, I wasn't able to go and come as I wanted.
Michael writes that in even though I'm embarrassed to admit I hadn't thought about this until the second time I heard Ayelet talk about the checkpoint, you know, there is a literal cage that Sam is in. But you write, Michael, in the essay, you describe the construct of the cage that Sam really lives in. Mm-hmm. And I just want to read a quick quote from what you wrote. You say, under occupation, every success was really a failure. Every victory a defeat. Every apparent triumph of the ordinary was really a gesture empty of any significance apart from reinforcing the unlimited power of Israel had to make it. That, more than any roadblock, checkpoint, border fence, or paper labyrinth of permits and identity cards, was the cage Sam Bahord lived in. Mm-hmm. So I think for people who are listening or who listen on July 6th on the radio or wherever this is going to appear, mm-hmm. who are not familiar with the conflict, as perhaps many of us in this room are, who are not, who are new to this story, I think a reasonable question that people would want to ask, and maybe some folks here are asking it of themselves now, is, well, why in the world would Israel do this? Right? Like, what? Like, there has to be a good reason for doing this. Mm-hmm. Is the reason Israel is maintaining what Jeff Halpern calls a matrix of control over the West Bank, over the occupied territories, is that because of the very real security concerns that Israel and Israelis have? And Yehuda, I wonder if you would address that. Why is this matrix of control, this 50-year attempt to really freeze and amber the lives of 2.3 million people, why is Israel doing this?
Again, this is already my opinion rather than what I've done physically and what the testimonies we collect in breaking the silence of soldiers who served in the occupied territories, by now over 1,100 men and women who served from 2000 to today and broke their silence. What is obvious from the testimonies and from the way the IDF behaves is that, you know, when you think of military occupations, either from a perspective of international law, strategic studies, whatever, you always think of a temporary reality. There was a war, you conquered a territory, you can't just disappear the next day, you manage the place, you leave some space for institutions to emerge so someone can replace you, and then you go out. If you look at how the Israeli occupation is designed, you actually understand that the behavior of the army on the ground is as if there is no exit strategy. Yeah, there is no end in sight. Yeah, and that's why the only way to rule people against their will forever, yeah, is not winning hearts and minds. It's not counterinsurgency. All these ideas. No, it's about creating fear, intimidation. Yeah, and once people get used to a level of fear, you have to increase it and increase it, and it's a hole without a bottom. So, at least from my understanding, we are behaving as a permanent reality. Our occupation is designed as such. And then I come and ask myself why. And it's because I give credit to our generals and to our leadership, and I don't think we're talking about a bunch of sadists who sit in an office and kind of like enjoy abusing Palestinians. The only answer I'm left is that this is a concept of security. It's a concept that people who shape national security strategy of the State of Israel, the way I understand them, they believe that we are in a zero-sum game. Between the river and the sea, there is room for one sovereign power. It's either us or the Palestinian. That's why it better be us. That's why Palestinians will never be free. That's what a permanent occupation is. And then you come to understand, at least for me, that this is why we haven't reached the two-state solution. Not because it was difficult, not because we didn't have a partner, not because the Lego of putting together the right coalition in Israel didn't work. No. It's because we don't want it. Because we see Palestinian independence as a national security problem to Israel. And that's, for me, a catastrophe. It's a catastrophe on a security and a strategic level. It's a catastrophe on a moral level. And the idea, anyone who believes that Israel will achieve stability and peace by stepping over millions of people for decades, I just don't buy it. I don't see it. You know, for 50 years we're trying, and it's not bringing us peace. And morally, not to talk about, you know, a permanent occupation over millions of people is morally indefensible. I don't see any way that one can justify it.
I agree. But I'd like to just make a quick note to add to the question of security. One of the things that pains and angers the Palestinians the most in this conflict is, you know, Israel's constant reference to security, whether when we are stopped and frisked randomly in places or, you know, discriminated against in our lives, or this brutal occupation that's in our face day in, day out, on the pretext of security. But I always tell my Israeli friends, my Jewish friends, and everybody else, you know, who cares about this conflict, I tell them, give the Palestinians a decent, free, and equal life where they are able to live a normal life and raise their children and, you know, have normal jobs and be able to travel and live just like normal human beings anywhere else in the world, and you will not have security concerns. The average person doesn't want to get up and blow themselves up or carry out attacks or do such things. The fact is that, you know, we are talking about 4 million severely repressed people and another, you know, 1.5 million who are discriminated against and who kind of live in a psychological cage that they try to navigate their life in every day. And I think Israel, you know, the Jewish people lived in Palestine before the formation of Israel, along with Christians and Muslims in peace. I met some Jewish people who referred to themselves as Jewish Palestinians because they were there before Israel. You know, I interviewed a few people for some pieces I did. They were there before Israel was created, and they referred to themselves as Jewish Palestinians. People can live in peace. We can all share this country. Before Israel was created, the Palestinians were there. You know, it wasn't just an empty piece of land. We suffered a huge displacement and a huge catastrophe, and the only way to right this wrong is to try and really live in peace together and to give people some repatriation of their rights, because that's ultimately the only way to achieve security for everyone concerned.
When we last spoke a few days ago in Berkeley, the five of us were together, and I asked you, Ayelet, about where you've found the hope, right? And, you know, we're here in San Francisco, and one of our great local heroes, Harvey Milk, said, you got to give him hope. And it's something that I've tried to always remember in my work, in doing what we do. But you all responded in a powerful way to me. And you essentially said, if I'll paraphrase, don't worry so much about hope, be part of the solution to the problem, right? Roll up your sleeves and get to work. So I want to thank the four of you, Ayelet and Michael and Fida and Yehuda, for rolling up your sleeves and getting to work to repair, the taken, to repair and to build something better than what's there now. And I want to thank all of you for being part of this conversation tonight. So thank you.
Thank
all.
You.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were writers Michael Chabon, Ayelet Waldman, and Fida Jurius, contributors to the Kingdom of Olives and Ash collection of essays, and Yehuda Shaul of the Israeli NGO Breaking the Silence. They were joined in conversation by New Israel Fund CEO Daniel Sokatch. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.